Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In the last six presidential elections, our guest this hour, Jim Lehrer, has served as moderator for 11 of the nationally televised debates among the candidates. In 1988, he moderated one presidential debate. In 92, he moderated two presidential debates. 96, the sole moderator of all three debates, two presidential and one vice presidential. In 2000, again selected as the sole moderator of the three presidential debates. 2004, moderator of the first presidential debate. 2008, moderator of the first presidential debate. Jim Lehrer writes about those experiences and other debates between presidential candidates and vice presidential candidates over the last many years. It was interesting to me in reading the book to think of it as a mini history lesson and realize how important these debates are, that there are certain, I'm sure you'll remember some of these when Michael Dukakis was asked this question about the death penalty, and a lot of people said his answer really did him in. Dan Quayle comparing himself to President Kennedy, perhaps once too often. There are a lot of these instances highlighted in the book that really had a significant impact, I think, on whether or not somebody was able to go on and successfully win the presidency. They're important. Jim is the author of, most recently, Tension City, Inside the Presidential Debates from Kennedy Nixon to Obama McCain. For over 35 years, he was the executive editor and anchor of PBS NewsHour. He is considered one of the most respected journalists in broadcast journalism. I guess that's obvious, or they wouldn't have asked him to moderate all these presidential debates. He is the author of 20 novels. We've talked with him about several of his novels, two memoirs, three plays. His wife, Kate, is a writer, author of four novels, and he and Kate have three daughters and six grandchildren. He's with us this hour as we talk about debates and get some real interesting behind-the-scenes looks at many of these debates. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Kathleen. Hi. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank
Good.
You.
Yeah, you sound real chipper this morning.
Well, you know what? It's an hour later here. See,
I guess that yeah. This is really, you know, what was fascinating is I remember so much history reading this book, and I realized these debates were darned important, weren't they?
Yeah, they really were. When you think about it, you can understand why, because they're the only time during the presidential campaign where the candidates can be seen together, literally standing on the same stage or sitting on the same stage, talking about the same things at the same time. And it is where it's usually toward the end, in the late September, early October, and substance and issues aside, what people are doing, no matter how they feel at that moment for whom they're going to vote, they're taking the measure of the candidates. Can I see this person? Can I imagine this person sitting behind the desk at the Oval Office and all that sort of thing? So they really do matter. There's no question about it.
You're pretty honest and actually self-critical in this book, too, which I found interesting, that you analyze your own performance. And when you're not up to par, you take yourself to task some. But you talk about the jitters that people get. And I want to talk about that a little bit, because it's a major thing to do to moderate a presidential debate. You got to be fair. You can't be accused of being nicer to one side than the other. You have to be down the middle. You have to ask absolutely the best question ever.
Yeah, it's tough going, and it's not enough just to be fair. You have to be perceived to have been fair.
Mm-hmm.
It is a devastating thing to be seen as having treated one candidate better or worse than the other, and the questions have to be apples and apples questions. You can't ask, a kind of a rough question of one candidate and not ask a comparable, doesn't have to be the exact question, but a comparable rough question of the other, because you would then be perceived as being being unfair, and you have to have done your homework to a level to a comfort level where you can listen to the answers.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody
mm-hmm.
says something, you can decide, hey, I'm going to follow up on it, or I'm going to ignore that. We've already heard that, or whatever. And you have to make sure, for me at least, the bottom line is, I don't want to do anything that causes anybody to be talking about me after the debate is over, something either good or bad. They should be talking about the candidates, what the candidates said, what the candidates did, not what the moderator said or did. So it's a hard show. There's no question about it. And it's exhilarating when it's over, but it's hell before you go, and it's tough while you're doing it.
Mm-hmm. So you must have heard some reaction to people who you worked with in some of the early debates, because they kept asking you to moderate again and again. Most people must have really liked the work that you did. You don't have to be modest.
Well, it wasn't. I'm not. You can't be too modest and appear on live television for 35 years. So the two things are kind of contradictory. But one of the reasons that I ended up moderating a lot of those debates was because they couldn't agree on anybody else. They didn't set out to say, okay, Jimmy Charles here is really good. Let's let him moderate all three or all two or whatever of the debates. They'd say, okay, let's get Lair to do the first one, and then we'll talk. And then let's talk about who's going to do the other. Then they couldn't agree on the other one, so they finally threw up their hands. Oh well, we can agree on Lair. Let him do it. And I'm not putting myself down. I'm not being phony modest there. I mean, obviously, if they didn't think I could do it adequately, they wouldn't. They wouldn't agree to me at all. So I'm not being stupid about it, but or silly about it. But I also know there is a process, and a couple of times they just really couldn't agree on anybody else, but they could agree on me. So that was it.
When you say that moderating the presidential debates is sometimes akin to walking down the blade of a knife, what do you mean?
Well, you just one false move and you can get cut. And you can cut. You can have a little nick, or you can have it can be a big cut. And I realize from the moment those things start. And by the way, once they start, it seems like boom, they're over. 90 minutes are usually a 90 minutes long. It just seems it's incredible to me always how quickly the debate is over. But the whole time, there's no time when you can really say, oh well, I'm in a groove now, I can relax and everything go, because the unexpected is lurking all the time. And no matter how well prepared you are intellectually on the issues or whatever, something can be said that that you didn't expect, or you're not prepared for, or you can lose sound, or miss a cue, or there are all kinds of little pitfalls and little bumps along the road that you have to avoid.
And those can throw you. You were almost locked out of one of the debates, weren't you? The Secret Service, one of these people didn't know who you were.
Yeah, this was in the debate between Bob Dole and Bill Clinton in Hartford, Connecticut. And what had happened was I had a little holding room that was down. It was this at a theater, a civic theater in Hartford. And I had a holding area downstairs, and I waited to go upstairs to do the debate. And I was down there waiting. A guy came down and said, "Okay, then it's time to put a mic on, take off your suit coat, and take off your credentials." The credentials being around my neck, and so I did that. And my friend and executive producer of the NewsHour, a guy named Les Crystal, was kind of my handler, and he was with me. And so I got all ready. Had the makeup on, and he carried my coat, and we went upstairs, and right up to the stage, where we're just a few yards from where the debate was going to be, and a Secret Service agent stopped me cold and said, "You can't go any further. Where are your credentials?" And I said, I was not terribly pleasant about it. I said, "I'm the moderator, and I need to see your credentials." And Crystal is desperately trying to find my credentials and my coat, which he was holding, Crystal was, and "You're not going anywhere," this guy said, or something like that, and without any credentials. And I said to him, not very nicely, I said, "Look, in a few minutes, about 3 minutes, the debate is going to start, and there's millions and millions of people watching, and there are three people required to make this thing work. I am one of the three. And I thought, my God, this guy's going to throw me against the wall and arrest me.
Oh, no.
And about that moment, two older Secret Service agents came up and said, oh, hey, we know who this guy is. He's a moderator. Let him go.
They better do their homework, too, these debates, huh? To find out who you are. There are some of these debates that are momentous occasions. Let's go to the Geraldine Ferraro appearance, and she knew how important it was. She felt like she was representing all the women in the country. It was a major event to have a woman on the ticket here. And how did it make everybody just a little bit more nervous? Did it make her more nervous? Did it make you more nervous?
It didn't make me more nervous. I actually didn't moderate that debate, but it made Geraldine Ferraro nervous. She said so. I mean, I did. See, Kathleen, the thing that I was so fortunate to do, in addition to moderating the debates, I later came back over a period of 20 years and interviewed most of the candidates for president and vice president who appeared in presidential in televised debates about their debate experiences. And so, and one of those people I interviewed was Geraldine Ferraro, and she told me that she was really nervous. And she felt she was representing, you know, all the women in America, but also she realized she was up against a seasoned politico, meaning George H.W. Bush, and so she was really nervous and said so, and then she got upset because she thought that George H.W. Bush had said something that was condescending to her about foreign affairs and that sort of thing. And so it was not a great experience for her. She did not enjoy herself.
And it makes you think about whether or not lines are rehearsed, because it was when Bush was talking about the difference between Iran and the embassy in Lebanon, and he said, let me help you with the difference. Her response was, I almost resent Vice President Bush, your patronizing attitude that you have to teach me about foreign policy. There are other lines that we remember that have been used in other debates. Do you think that the campaigns deliberately have rehearsed lines and they just look for the right opportunity to put them in? Because they're memorable.
Yes, they do. That's exactly right. But in my interviews with these candidates, there was only one who admitted they did that, that he did that, and that was Bill Clinton. He said, oh, yeah, we did that all the time. I had all kinds of lines all ready to go just in case I needed them. Some of them I could use. Some of them I couldn't use. I didn't use many of them, but I had them. But nobody, for instance, Geraldine Ferraro denied that she had that line ready to go. Don't condescend to me. The great line of Lloyd Benson, Dan Quayle about you're no Jack Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Benson, not an interview with me because he had a stroke and I wasn't able to talk to him, but he had said in other earlier interviews that all that just came to him. Well, it was later said that the people who were getting Benson ready for the debate expected Quayle to say that. He'd already said that before, this thing about comparing himself to Jack Kennedy, and somebody had suggested that line, so that didn't come out of nowhere. Ronald Reagan, famous lines, I'm not going to use the age issue Walter Mondale, and I'm not going to make an issue out of my opponent's youthful and inexperience, et cetera. And there you go again, the line that he used against Jimmy Carter. Most people believe that those lines were ready. Ronald Reagan told me, no, it just came to me to say. And so, you know, these things, everybody has their own memories and their own way of describing what happened.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that almost all of these people, unless they were very sick, did interviews with you, but Al Gore didn't. Why?
Well, I don't know. I think my guess is he was all very apparently very pleasant about it when our folks talked to him and his folks many, many times asking to be interviewed. My own view of it is, and this is strictly speculation on my part, is that the 2000 election was a god-awful experience for him.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess is that has always been that he just didn't want to talk about it. And that someday he will, and I say this in the book, that someday he will write his own book about the 2000 election, and probably include his debate experiences in it, because those debate experiences were very important in 2000, and he did not do himself many favors in those debates. And some people even suggest that his performance, particularly in the first one in Boston, where he sighed and grimaced and all of that, hurt him, and hurt him in a way that affected the outcome of the election. I don't know if that's true or not, but there's some people who believe that. And so I guess my guess has always been that the reason he didn't want to talk about it is he just didn't want to talk about 2000.
Mm-hmm. And did he not learn a lesson from Richard Nixon back in 1960 that it may be not as important, but you need to be very, very careful about how you look in addition to what you say?
Well, exactly. Nixon said that very thing, because remember in that 1960 debate, Nixon had been sick, and he came in, he looked sick, and Howard K. Smith, who was the moderator, said, Mr. Vice President, we have a big makeup person here, if you'd like to make up. And he said, no makeup. And somebody put some powder on him, and that was it. And he looked terrible. And Kennedy, in contrast, looked like $1 million. He was all tanned, and some people said he was tanned because he had Addison's disease, and his treatment caused his skin to tan. But whatever, he looked like a warrior, you know, ready to fight. And poor Nixon there, I mean, he also sweated. He had a fever, and there was sweat on it over his lip, and all of this. It left a negative effect. And Nixon said in his own memoir about that debate, he said, I spent too much time worrying about what I was going to say and not enough time about the way I looked. Mm-hmm. And as I said, and I say in the book, candidates from then on should keep that in mind.
Mm. I had no idea, Jim, that Bernard Shaw's question of Michael Dukakis on the death penalty, the behind-the-scenes story on that, and it created so much controversy among the panelists.
Yeah, there were three panelists. That was in the old days when there was a moderator and then three journalists, all of them journalists, and then three panelists. And the three panelists in that debate, Bernie was the moderator, and the three panelists were Margaret Warner, who was in with Newsweek and of course now with the NewsHour, the PBS NewsHour, my colleague, Andrea Mitchell, who was with NBC News and still is, and Ann Compton, who was with ABC News and still is. And those three, Andrea, Ann, and Margaret, tried to talk Bernie out of asking that question. They had a little meeting beforehand in a hotel room going over their questions. And Bernie finally told him that he was going to ask that question, and they pleaded with him not to. They thought it was, you know, improper, particularly to use Kitty Dukakis's name. And he said, "No, I'm going to ask the question." So there was quite a to-do. And Bernie was offended by the fact that they would even ask him. And I asked him afterward, you know, in my interview for the book, whether he had any second thoughts about the question. He said, "I don't even have any first thoughts about it. I thought it was a fair question then, and I still do."
And yet there are certain questions you have to wonder, are you writing this question so that people will say, "Oh, what a great question."
Yeah. You know, I'm not putting any of that kind of motive on Bernie, but you know, that is what a moderator must always guard against. It is never about the moderator. It is never about the question.
Right,
it's always about the answers. And you have to ask a question to elicit an answer. Now, Bernie would argue that that question was revealing about the character of Michael Dukakis. Michael Dukakis took that as a routine question about the death penalty, rather than saying, "Oh my God, if somebody killed my wife, I'd kill him myself."
Mm-hmm.
You know, he showed no emotion, because he saw it as an issue question, not as an emotional question. And David Broder of the Washington Post, who was political editor then, said at the time that cost Dukakis the election by just not the question, but the answer, the way he handled it. And if he had been emotional about it, then he might have not only gotten away with it, it might have even scored some points. But that didn't happen.
It's strange, isn't it? Because as you write in your book, Obviously, Michael Dukakis was asked about his position on the death penalty numerous times. It shouldn't have come out of left field in terms of what the appropriate response should be in front of a national audience.
Yeah, but see, what he said to me was, he said he'd talked about the death penalty so often that he assumed incorrectly, because he'd been the governor of Massachusetts, he'd been in public life a long time, and he'd always been an opponent capital punishment, that it was just a continuation of an ongoing dialogue that he'd always had about capital punishment. He did not extrapolate that into the fact that this was before millions and millions of people who had never heard him speak at all,
right,
much less
right.
about capital punishment, and they were mm-hmm. getting introduced to him. And as he said, he still thinks his answer was fine. I mean, he made a mistake. Anybody can make a mistake, but I must say I don't feel as badly about that question as others do, because it seemed a natural way to answer that question because of my views.
And his wife, tell us about the encounter that his wife had with Bernard Shaw later.
She was very upset when the debate happened, when Bernie asked the question, and said it was very unfair, and said this publicly to reporters. Several years later, she was in Los Angeles at an event where Bernie was, and somebody introduced Bernie to Kitty Dukakis, and Kitty said, "I just want you to know, Bernie, that I now, when I look back on it, I think that was a fair question, and I regret saying that it was unfair and all that sort of stuff." And Dukakis himself told me that he also thought the question was a fair question. He had neither one of them, when the final analysis, had any criticism of Bernie having asked the question.
Jim Lehrer is our guest this hour. His latest book, and we have to talk about why he gave it this title. It comes from what one of the candidates said about what it was like to be in one of these debates. Tension City, Inside the Presidential Debates from Kennedy Nixon to Obama McCain, My View from the Middle Seat. Jim Lehrer has moderated a number of presidential debates in the last six elections. He's been moderator for 11 of the nationally televised debates among the candidates, and he also has gone back and interviewed as many people who were healthy enough or alive to talk about their experiences in these debates, and included what they had to say about the answers that they gave and the atmosphere and how pivotal a debate may or may not have been in ultimate election or defeat. Here's our phone number. Lines are open for you, and we're going to go to you momentarily. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, Dana Priest will be joining us. Her latest book is Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. She is an investigative reporter for The Washington Post and has received a couple Pulitzer Prizes for her work. Jim Lehrer is here now, and we're talking about the presidential debates and welcoming your phone calls. Daniel from Rice Lake is our first caller. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. If these debates are so important, how could Reagan, after his debacle debating Mondale, where Reagan was totally confused and betrayed his early Alzheimer's, have won his second term reelection?
Well, because there was another subsequent debate in which Reagan recouped from his mistake, from his bad performance. You're absolutely right. The first debate, Reagan did poorly, and Mondale won hands down. But there was the second debate. What Reagan said to me was, I asked him what went wrong. And he said, well, I was just overprepared. I had everybody telling me what to do and all of that. And I was tired, and I was overprepared, they'd ask me a question. I kept thinking, what am I supposed to say here and all that. And he said, I blew it. And he said, for the next debate, I decided no handlers, no whatever, and I just winged it based on what my own mind told me to say, and he did much better. And that's the debate that he made that line to Mondale, where Mondale told me, he said he knew he lost the election. when Reagan said that to him about, I'm not going to make an issue out of my opponent's youth and inexperience. And so what he did is he recovered and from the mistake of the first debate.
Do you feel that you were ever overprepared, Jim?
Oh, I was one time in particular. I had come up with a system for how I was going to do my follow-ups and all of that. And it was very complicated, and it was too complicated, and I lost track of where I was. Fortunately, I came to my senses early, and I was in the debate between John Kerry and George W. Bush in Miami. And I wasn't overprepared from a content standpoint. I was overprepared. The rules were a little complicated, and I was trying to figure out a way to use the rules, honestly, but to use the rules to do some follow-ups, which were not especially part of the rules. And anyhow, I overcomplicated the thing, and then I realized it early enough to keep from making a real fool of myself.
Daniel, thanks for the call.
Yes,
Jim and Pleasant. Oh, wait a second. We got this button thing not working. There we go. Now we go to Jim from Pleasant Prairie. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Yes, good morning. First, I want to thank Mr. Lehrer for his very worthwhile public career, and I've appreciated that for a long time.
Thank you.
But at the same time, I really question the use of the word debates. Because it seems like we really, instead of debates, have developed a system of joint press conferences. And with this system, the candidates have virtually no opportunity to cross-examine each other. And also, when the it's a consensus of many critical viewers that. The loss of the when the debates were moderated by the League of Women Voters were expelled from doing so because they were asking more critical questions. And so anyway, it seems like we've gotten away from more serious statesmen and gotten more into a largely because of television. Gotten into a system where the so-called parties are producing canned commercial products.
Jim.
I couldn't disagree with you more. Every point that you went through, I disagree with. There's no point in going through it all. I think you're not paying attention. There's 100 million people that watch those debates. And as I said earlier to Kathleen, those debates are about seeing these people who want to be president of the United States. If you talk about it, there is no such thing as a pure debate. They always talk about the Lincoln-Douglas debate. You know about the Lincoln-Douglas debate? The opening statement of the first candidate was an hour and a half. The response was an hour and a half. Then they had another one-minute rebuttal and whatever. And opened a debate is everybody is in the eye of the beholder. There are all kinds of different kinds of debate. You can call them anything you want to. The important thing is that when the candidates for president of the United States are on the same stage at the same time talking about things that matter, it is an important event in the presidential election. To say that these things are all staged and they're all canned, that is not true. I know that for a fact. Yes, there are these candidates, they want to avoid making mistakes. Who doesn't? You know, a candidate can, I mean, George H.W. Bush looked at his watch and almost lost the presidency because of that. He lost the election, not because of that, but, I mean, these things are important. And to suggest that it's all kind of canned and everything, I don't think that would be the case. I don't think 100 million people would be watching if that were the case. I just think, I just go through your every point, and the fact of the League of Women Voters, if you remember the League of Women Voters, they also allowed cheers and all that sort of stuff, and they became pep rallies and all. I'm not knocking the League of Women Voters. There were a lot of, you know, there are always going to be problems. There's no such thing as a perfect event, because there are no such thing as perfect people involved in any of these things. So yes, some of them are not whatever. But I don't know what even constitutes a perfect debate anymore. And I've been doing this more than most people. Not only just in the presidential debates, but I've been involved in moderating discussions among people who disagree for 40 years. And there's no perfect way of doing it because, as I say, there's no perfect. There's no one way of doing it. Sometimes a town hall meeting works, but sometimes town hall meetings are canned. Can be more canned than a debate with a moderator or whatever. It is just a. Yeah, we are an open democracy, and we have an open process. And sometimes some of these exchanges work really well. Sometimes they don't. But to suggest that it's all useless because it's canned is totally wrong, in my opinion.
All right, Jim, thanks very much for the call. Let's spend a little more time talking about those town hall meetings. It seems to me as though that format was better for some candidates than for others. I'm thinking Bill Clinton, who did very well in that kind of town hall format. Tell me about what you had to go through as a moderator to make sure, because you do want to make sure that a cross-section of America is asking important questions. How do you accomplish that?
Well, it's very difficult. The way those things work, they choose the Gallup organization, I think it's still the Gallup organization, chooses a cross-section of voters in a particular city. Cross-section politically and gender and in race and in age and all of that, and there are about 140 people, and they're brought into a room and to a location, and they're asked to write down a couple of questions, and they're not given any guidelines about content, but on your best to ask a very straightforward question, all that sort of stuff. And then those questions are then given in this to the moderator, and then the moderator goes through, knowing full well, at least the ones I moderated, and that's true of all of them, over a period of 90 minutes, you're going to get to about 22 questions out of those 140, and there are 140 people, so that means you got 280 questions, and you have to choose 22, 24, 25 people and or 25 questions to be asked. And you have to you go through it as a professional and decide these are the best questions. Then you have to make sure that the people asking the questions are representative. It's a very difficult process, and it is completely spontaneous once it begins. In other words, you then call on Billy Bob to ask his or her question, and then the candidate responds. No candidate ever knows any of the questions ahead of time in any of these debates, whether they're asked by people at town hall meetings or by moderators like me or anybody else. There is never any sharing of the questions ahead of time. So there's no canned thing. Somebody could give a canned answer if they wanted to, but they do that at their peril.
Sure.
Because the audience is as smart as anybody else, and they know if somebody's given a canned answer. If you ask, I remember one time one of these candidates was asked by a young person, what do you have to say to the young people of America? And this guy, who shall remain nameless, people may remember him, but he just started talking about Social Security. I mean, kind of a canned answer about Social Security. Well, the public saw that,
mm-hmm.
and it was a negative for him. But this was an ordinary citizen who asked that question. I mean, drawn from the pool. And I had chosen. I happened to be the moderator, and I chose the questions. I remember that. But there are some of these debates during the primaries that are a little more spontaneous, but not that much in terms of somebody stands up and just arbitrarily asks a question, whether it's wide open. But that's not going to happen very often because it's a risky business,
right.
And a lot of these candidates' handlers, urge them to stay away from risky situations because so much is at stake, and you can make a mistake. I say, with a gesture as well as a word. And you can cost yourself the presidency of the United States.
Tim in Colorado. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I'd like to make two really short comments and then ask Jim a question. My first comment is, I think it'd be highly entertaining if we had a presidential candidate whose name was Billy Bob.
Yeah. Make it easy for me.
I think it might change the dynamics.
Yeah.
And I want to compliment you both. You're both Kathleen and Mr. Lehrer are both consummate professionals, and it's just a privilege to be talking to both of you, quite honestly.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm wondering just a general question, if you could change any of the aspects of the presidential debates that as how they occur right now, what would your preferences be?
Well, I think the I'm not a format fanatic on these. I think, as I said earlier, as long as they're standing there or sitting there talking about things that matter, it's okay. I thought the format that was used in the first 2008 presidential debate between John McCain and Barack Obama was a pretty good form, a pretty good format where. I was the moderator, and I was just following the rules. You ask a question, the first one, and you get a 2-minute answer or 1-minute response, and then, at the discretion of the moderator, you can continue the discussion among the candidates on that issue, that on that question, for up from 5 to 9 minutes. And I did that, and under the rules. The candidates were allowed to question each other and allowed to speak directly to each other for the first time. John McCain chose not to do that. I tried my best to get McCain to even look at Obama, some of you may remember, and McCain chose not to do that. And so there was no direct questioning. There was a little bit toward the end, but not much. But it's to me, I think that would be the best format.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. Why did we go, Jim, for so many years with no presidential debate following the Kennedy-Nixon debate?
Well, because the incumbent presidents were Richard Nixon and Lyndon Johnson, and both of them decided that they had only things to lose with these presidential debates and nothing to win. And so they just said, no, they're not going to be any. And there is no law or even any pattern. At that point, there had only been that one set with the Kennedy-Nixon, and so there was no impetus, no imperative that they debate, and they didn't, and we went until 1976 before there was another debate, and that was between Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, and that the only reason that happened was because Gerald Ford was way behind in the polls because of the Nixon pardon and all kinds. He was 17-20 points down to Jimmy Carter, and he thought the only way he could possibly make up time is to make up this gap was to have some televised debates, and so that's what drove it. And then from then on there have been presidential, and it's every once in a while it was the early times when some of these candidates would say, well, I'm not sure we're going to do it and whatever, but the public pressure to debate is there forever, and I think there's no way in the world any presidential candidate could avoid a nationally televised debate now.
You would hope that they would just consider it part of their responsibility, wouldn't you?
Exactly, and that's what's happened.
Yeah.
That is what's happened now. There's no question about it. As I say, no candidate could get away. I asked, in fact, in the book, I asked George H.W. Bush, do you think it should be required by law that candidates submit to these presidents? He said, no, I do not. He said, I think it should be up to a candidate. If a candidate thinks it would help him or her, debate. If he thinks it would hurt him or her, don't debate. And he's the only one who said that. The other ones think it should be a required process.
Hmm. Boyd in Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen, and hello to you, Jim.
Hi.
Jim. When you have had to moderate the various debates and then you have to go over certain topics, are there any topics that maybe, of course, you have to go over these regardless, but it might be difficult because they're so complicated? To narrow it down, I think of the various social issues out there. Earlier in the show, you were talking a little bit about capital punishment, but, you know, you can also change it with abortion or euthanasia, or in recent years, gay marriage, and still even up to this day, race relations. The reason I just go there is because I look at the establishment media and the way that all these issues are just reported is just so, I feel, sensationalized, and there's a lot of misinformation, and it's practically just disingenuous.
Yeah. Well, my own private practice has been that in these presidential debates is that it's not my job to introduce new subjects. That by the time we go to, as I say, to October, the debate should be about the issues of the campaign. and to resolve differences or to expand differences or whatever. And because it'd be very easy to ask gotcha questions, suddenly out of the blue say, by the way, let's go through who some of the world leaders are. Who's the president of Uzbekistan?
Right.
You know, stuff like that. Gotcha questions, you could do that. I believe that you should pursue the things that are already there. I agree with you, and I know of no, at least in my case, I never did not ask a question or raise a subject because I thought it was too complicated. In fact, they were quite the contrary. It's the complicated ones I feel that you need to go at so they can you can force the candidates to explain them in ways that a huge number of people can understand. And nobody has any, to repeat, nobody has any say-so about the only decision that's made ahead of time is that, all right, this debate is going to be about domestic affairs. That debate is going to be about foreign affairs and national security. But nobody has any control except the moderator over what the specific questions are going to be or what the subjects themselves are going to be.
Jim Lehrer is our guest, and his book is Tension City, Inside the Presidential Debates from Kennedy-Nixon to Obama-McCain, My View from the Middle Seat, which is a place where he's been on many an occasion. Well, here's our phone number. Thanks, Boyd, for your call. Line is open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls for Jim Lehrer, Shirley in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Shirley.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, Shirley.
Hi. I'd like to thank Jim for his role in these debates. It's a very difficult job that he does. Earlier, there was a comment about the League of Women Voters, and I know personally it's not easy to conduct those kinds of forums. My question is this. Would Jim comment on the role of the League of Women Voters in conducting the hundreds of candidate forums and debates that it does annually for local and state elections?
Well, I don't have a lot of personal hands-on knowledge about how they do their debating, but I have a long-standing respect and admiration for the League of Women Voters, period.
Thanks, Shirley, for the call. Fred in Watersmead, Michigan. Hi, Fred.
Hi, guys. Jim, it's an honor. I loved listening to your show.
Thank you.
My question is, what bugs me on these debates is, where the moderator doesn't keep the candidates on topic and doesn't make them answer the question, and they proceed to just elicit their talking points. And it just seems like it's getting out of hand. Is there anything that can be done about that?
No. If a candidate does not want to answer a question, there's no way you can force somebody to answer it. What you can do is just expose the fact that he or she is not answering the question. Because I start every, and I'm talking for myself now, I assume when I ask somebody a question on television or in a presidential debate or whatever, that the audience is just as smart as I am, and they're paying attention just as closely as I am. I ask a question, and the candidate doesn't answer it. Then I ask it again, and the candidate doesn't answer. What am I supposed to say? Hey, you're not answering a question. No, that's not a moderator's job. That's for the viewer to say, as you just said, Fred, you know, he's not answering the question. You put that in, you digest that and make a judgment about that candidate based on that. There's no way in hell any moderator can ever get somebody to talk if they don't want to. You can't get somebody to say something that they don't want to say. All you can do, as I say, is be party to exposing the fact that that person didn't answer the question.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Isn't that a source of continual frustration in doing interviews and in actually even discussing some events that people have put together these, this is what I'm going to say, this is how I'm going to say it. It somehow gets distributed among many people and everybody says the same thing. And you say, wait a second, there's a deeper discussion that needs to take place here. Don't give me the one line.
Yeah. Well, you can do that without, I don't believe in abusing people. You know, I don't believe that's the moderator's role or an interviewer's role. I think what the interviewer's job or the moderator's job is to ask the questions in such a way that it's direct inescapable. In other words, you either answer it or you are seen clearly not answering it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you might ask the question three times and you don't get an answer. Then the issue is, do you keep going? What do you do? And sometimes I've gone away too soon. Sometimes I've stayed too long. There's no questions. It's not a science. And as I say, I do these things for the audience. I'm not doing this for me. It'd be very easy to beat up on somebody. I mean, that's easy. You don't have to go to journalism school to learn how to beat up on people. I mean, that's not what I want. That's not what I'm going to do.
Right.
Somebody else wants to do that as a moderator or as an interviewer. So be it. Do that. That's not what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And because I really do believe the folks are with me, and they'll say, "Well, he's not going to answer the question. This fool just didn't answer the question." That's great. They know that, and I don't have to tell them that. And there are other people, you know. I've been doing it so many years, I know there are people sitting out there. They've told me this. They've been waiting for me to someday ask somebody a question, they'll give an answer, and it's not true, or I think it's not true, and I'll yell, "Liar!" You know, not going to happen. It's not my way of doing it. And so anybody who watches me do these things or listens to me do these kinds of things is stuck with that.
Fred, thanks very much, and a lot of people appreciate that that's the way you do things. Rick in Monona, hi.
Hi, I'm enjoying your show today very much. I had a question about the participants in the presidential debates. I know I read a story about Ralph Nader trying to get into the debates a few years ago when he ran for president, and that he wasn't invited to it, that he said it seems to me that it's run by a corporation or another entity, not Democrat or Republican. And he claims that when he showed up at the debate and just tried to go in the hall, that the police stopped him and made him leave. Do you have any comments about that, Mr.
That was in Boston. I moderated that debate. The moderator didn't have anything to do with who is invited to debate or not, or any. All I knew about the arrest of Nader was what I read in the newspapers the next day. I have anything to do with that, I can honestly say.
How difficult is it to moderate a debate when you've got somebody who is a third-party candidate? I'm thinking specifically about somebody like Ross Perot.
Well, it just makes it more interesting and makes it more difficult because you've got three people that for whom you have to protect on a fairness issue.
Right.
And you have to make sure that all three get heard fairly and as reasonably equal time, et cetera. But it makes for an interesting. I mean, the debates among Perot, Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush were very interesting, no question about it. And Perot certainly made his contributions because he was very outspoken and very direct. And he took the position that he wasn't going to criticize George H.W. Bush or Bill Clinton, and he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
All he did was talk about his issues, which was mostly in light of what's going on now, it was about the national debt.
Right.
Budget, mostly.
Right. It's interesting to me, and I guess this is only natural, but they compared it to different sports, what George W. Bush, Jimmy Carter, and Gerald Ford, how they compared their experiences to competitive athletics.
Well, I know. I noticed that. They used those analogies because that's how they saw it. And it is high-level competition. There's no question about it.
Is it more to you like tennis or football or baseball?
Well, it isn't for me. I mean, the moderator, it's a little more gritty than a game. As I say, I don't want to be the person who asked the dumb question or let something fall through the cracks or did a stupid thing that affects the outcome of an election. And that is an election for President of the United States is not a game. It's a serious thing where you're choosing the who's going to be the next leader of the free world, and to me that is not games.
So I know you're somewhat retired now, hardly. You're writing books, et cetera, and
yeah,
doing a lot. But could you be, if somebody asked you, and I'm sure maybe they're thinking about you for 2012, the answer is yeah, I'd consider it or not.
No.
Consider
it. No, I'm Sherman on that one. I'm definitely not going to do any more. I've done mine. I wrote this book. and I wanted to be free when I wrote the book to say whatever I wanted to say. And I am under no circumstances would I moderate another debate.
Thank you, Jim.
I've done it.
Okay,
and
yeah.
I had a great experience. I'm honored to have been asked. It's time for other folks to do it.
Thank you, Jim, so much for writing the book. It's just so interesting, and thanks, as always, for being with us.
The pleasure is always mine, Kathleen. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Jim Lehrer. And the book is Tension City, Inside the Presidential Debates from Kennedy-Nixon to Obama-McCain, My View from the Middle Seat. It has just been published by Random House. He's a man of many talents, isn't he? The last time we talked to him, it was about his train novel, Murder Mystery. Remember that one? That's it for this hour. That's it for this show. That's it for this Tuesday for me, but many interesting conversations ahead. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the show, Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thanks for listening. We'll have good shows tomorrow. Dana Priest will be with us on Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State during the 10 o'clock hour, and something timely at 9. Thank you for listening.